on the dossier, the Times intentionally misled readers with the following chronology. 1. In September 2015, a Washington political research firm, Fusion GPS, paid by a wealthy Republican donor who did not like Mr. Trump, began to compile opposition research on him. 2. Last June, after evidence of Russian hacking of Democratic targets surfaced, Fusion GPS hired a retired British intelligence officer, Christopher Steele, to investigate Mr. Trump's ties to Russia. 3. After it became clear that Mr. Trump would be the Republican nominee, Democratic clients who supported Hillary Clinton began to pay Fusion GPS for this same opposition research. Any person reading that timeline would assume that the first two items came before the third. The dossier was compiled for a GOP donor, and then later, a Democratic donor came in and said, "Hey, can we take this Russia dossier off your hands?" But the timeline is out of order. Obviously, no Republican was paying for research on Trump after May 3rd, when his last GOP rival dropped out. Steele wasn't hired by Fusion GPS until June. Why, in the Times list, does June come before May? It's like saying, 1. Ivana divorced Donald Trump. 2. Donald Trump began dating Marla Maples. What, did I say anything that's untrue? Or how about this? 1. Bush invaded Afghanistan. 2. Osama bin Laden was killed in a raid. 3. Obama became president. The Times' sleazy, non-chronological ordering of events was a calculated attempt to create the false impression that a Republican had originally financed the dossier. Evidently, it was very important to keep the Democrats as far away from the dossier as possible. And it worked for 10 joyful months. In the halcyon days before the public knew that Steele was working for Hillary Clinton, the media cited the FBI's reliance on the dossier as proof of its bona fides. The dossier was like Kim Kardashian. Why is she famous? Because she's famous. Why was the dossier credible? Because the FBI believed it. The circularity of that argument became clear only when it turned out the dossier was nothing more than Hillary Clinton's opposition research. Inasmuch as the Democrats and the media would soon be denouncing the idea that the FBI had ever taken the Russia dossier seriously, let's review their months of gloating over the FBI's absolute devotion to the sleazy file. It was only much later, when we found out that the dossier had been funded by the Democrats, that the FBI's faith in it became a vicious Republican lie. In March 2017, Michael Isikoff of Yahoo News reported the stunning information that it was the dossier that had sparked the FBI's Trump investigation. The Bureau's investigation, he said, began just a few weeks after Christopher Steele, the ex-British spy who was the author of that dossier, first briefed FBI agents about the contents of his reports. So it appears more and more that he set the ball in motion, set the chain of events in motion that led to this investigation. A few days later, NBC News' Ken Delinian vouched for the dossier's allegations by noting that the FBI was prepared to pay Christopher Steele to investigate for them. And you know, I'm told as many as 100 FBI agents are assigned to this investigation at 3 different field offices around the country. Cut to sound of gunfire at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, because the FBI was too busy spying on Trump to investigate Nicholas Cruz. In April, CNN broke the news that the FBI had used the dossier to obtain a FISA warrant on Trump campaign advisor Carter Page. Well, now the dossier had to be true. You don't get a FISA warrant on uncorroborated gossip. What do you say now, Trumpsters? CNN's Erin Burnett opened her show with the exciting news. New details about an explosive dossier about Russian ties to Donald Trump's campaign. A CNN exclusive this hour. Evan Perez came on to report, Breaking news, the FBI used the now infamous dossier of allegations of Russian ties to Donald Trump's campaign to get a warrant to secretly monitor a Trump associate. Former CIA operative Robert Baer told Burnett he was stunned. The fact that the dossier had been used for a FISA warrant, he said, tells me that they had faith in the explosive dossier. He remarked that he put a lot more credence in this dossier than I did initially, and the fact that they based the FISA warrant partially on it, that's explosive in itself. The next morning, on CNN's New Day, Chris Cuomo reported that the FBI used the dossier to convince a secret U.S. court to allow surveillance on a top Donald Trump associate. That meant, he explained, that the FBI saw in that dossier articulable facts that they could give to a judge as a basis of reasonable belief about Carter Page, and the judge bought it. Later that day, CNN's Kate Baldwin triumphantly cited the dossier's use in a FISA application to challenge former Congressman Pete Hoekstra. I remember pretty distinctly that you supported President Trump's criticism of this dossier. Do you want to dial back that criticism now? CNN's report swept through MSNBC like wildfire. Chris Matthews said the FBI's use of the dossier to get a FISA warrant means the investigators may have independently corroborated parts of the dossier. That's news. Rachel Maddow said that the FISA warrant on Page proved that parts of this dossier passed muster, even in federal court. Try calling the dossier tainted now, Republicans. The dossier had to be true. It just had to be. It wasn't as though it hadn't occurred to anyone to ask who had paid for the dossier until October 24, 2017. Republicans had been screaming from the rooftops that they wanted to know the name of the secret donor. The FBI and the Department of Justice remained silent. A week before the court forced Fusion GPS to reveal the client, Democrats were denouncing Republican Congressman Devin Nunes for continuing to meddle around the edges of the investigation, as the New York Times put it, driving Republican inquiries into who financed the dossier. Exasperated Democrat Adam Schiff said, "I view these things as obstacles that are in the way to overcome, and I am doing my best to overcome them almost daily." On October 21, 2017, just days before we found out that the dossier was Clinton-funded opposition research, Trump tweeted that the FBI should immediately release who paid for it. Then finally, on October 24, 2017, Clinton campaign DNC paid for research that led to Russia dossier, The Washington Post. So how did Rachel Maddow break the bad news that the Russia dossier had been funded by the Clinton campaign? Quote, "Well, tonight, after months of Republicans prying on this issue with a crowbar, tonight the Washington Post was first to report that the Democratic donor who took over funding the dossier for the general election was a lawyer representing the Clinton campaign and the DNC, Mark Elias." Democratic donor Mark Elias. Maddow described Elias as a donor who was in favor of Hillary Clinton's campaign. Yes, in the sense that he was a partner at the law firm Cutout hired by the Clinton campaign to pay for the Russian dossier. Please disregard everything we've said for the past 10 months about the dossier. 2 days after the staggering revelation about the dossier's secret donor, Robert Litt, an intelligence lawyer in the Obama administration, wrote, "Much has been made this week of reports that the Clinton campaign paid for the so-called dossier about Trump that was compiled by a former British intelligence agent. One important point is sometimes lost in the discussion. The dossier itself played absolutely no role in the coordinated intelligence assessment that Russia interfered in our election." After carrying on about the dossier all year, the resistance did an immediate about-face, insisting the dossier was an irrelevant distraction. Frankly, they were baffled by Republicans' fixation on it. Consider this exchange on CNN Tonight with Don Lemon, 1 week after Hillary was exposed as the secret donor behind the Russia dossier. Lemon: we just heard the president say in a radio interview that he thinks the FBI used the dossier to order a FISA warrant. What's your reaction to that? Chris Saliza, CNN politics reporter: well, I mean, he says a lot of things, most of which are either provably false or wind up being false. Flashback, April 18th, 2017, CNN. Breaking news, the FBI used the now infamous dossier of allegations of Russian ties to Donald Trump's campaign to get a warrant to secretly monitor a Trump associate. I salute Don and Chris for not watching their own network. But I really admire CNN's Allison Camerota for ignoring her New Day co-host, Chris Cuomo. Camerota, January 3rd, 2018. This is why I think this is so important, guys, because, as you know, there are all sorts of Republican lawmakers who have come on our show, namely Jim Jordan, to say that he has a hunch that it was the dossier that he believes was the trigger to go to the FISA court to get the warrant and then wiretap some people on the Trump campaign. Carter Page. Flashback, April 19th, 2017. Chris Cuomo on CNN's New Day. The FBI saw in that dossier articulable facts that they could give to a judge as a basis of reasonable belief about Carter Page, and the judge bought it. On Aaron Burnett's Out Front, the very show that had broken the news that the dossier had been used for a FISA warrant against Page, CNN correspondent Jessica Schneider said the conservatives accused the FBI of relying on the Steele dossier in its own investigations, and they want to know how and if the FBI used the dossier to obtain FISA warrants on Trump associates. Flashback, Aaron Burnett, CNN, April 18th, 2017. Sources, FBI used Trump dossier to help get secret wiretap warrant on associate in Russia investigation. Here are a few more flashbacks from CNN. On a single day, April 19th, 2017. Kate Baldwin: source, FBI used British dossier for Trump associate FISA warrant. Anderson Cooper: sources, FBI used Trump dossier to help get secret wiretap warrant on associate in Russia investigation. Chris Cuomo: sources, FBI used Trump dossier to help get secret wiretap warrant on associate in Russia investigation. The unfortunate discovery that the Clinton campaign and the DNC had paid Russians for dirt on Hillary's opponent didn't even put a dent in the Trump colluded with Russia story. Oh, sure, they stopped citing the dossier as if it were the Rosetta Stone. But other than that, the accusations that Trump colluded with Russia continued without pause. They had a hole card. George Papadopoulos, recent college grad and Model UN participant, who had been in a meeting with Trump once. Chapter 17. George Papadopoulos, Headline Writer's Nightmare. The main point of the Russian collusion story is to create a patina of illegality around President Trump. The crime of which he is accused is meaningless, even if true, but his name must be made synonymous with Russian collusion. On closer examination, the charges are incoherent jibes, conjoining different events, adding up to a totally contradictory account. But the media just keep moving fast, moving and moving and moving, playing games with words and facts to create the impression that they have a point. One of the biggest fake-outs is the Hillary emails. There are two entirely different sets of emails. The FBI and the media confuse them to create a semi-plausible story to answer the genesis question. Why did the Bureau begin investigating the Trump campaign in the first place? First, it was the dossier that sparked the FBI investigation. Then we found out the dossier was a Hillary-funded opposition research project, so no, it wasn't the dossier at all. Then it was international man of mystery Carter Page, a man so dangerous that our own government took out a FISA warrant on him. Then we found out that the principal evidence against him was the notorious dossier. Next, we saw the first batch of texts Peter Strzok had sent to his FBI mistress, and it seemed that the lead investigator on the FBI's Russia investigation was an anti-Trump zealot. At that point, the entire weight of the Russia investigation came down to 28-year-old Trump aide George Papadopoulos and his drunken confession to an Australian diplomat about Hillary's emails. The diplomat, Australian High Commissioner to the United Kingdom, Alexander Downer, contacted the FBI in the summer of 2016, claiming that Papadopoulos had known about the WikiLeaks disclosures 2 months before Julian Assange began posting them. This was huge. Ezra Klein tweeted, "It is difficult to believe that Papadopoulos told an Australian diplomat that Russia had dirt on Clinton, but didn't mention anything to the campaign he was part of. Very difficult. Virtually impossible." This tweet was considered so insightful that it made the Washington Post. There's your smoking gun, Trumpsters. The New York Times claimed it was the FBI's breathtaking discovery that Papadopoulos may have had inside information about the Russian hacking of the DNC that was a driving factor in the Bureau's opening of the Russia-Trump conspiracy investigation. First of all, so what? Papadopoulos heard the Russians had emails embarrassing to Hillary. What was he supposed to do, unhear it? In fact, the FBI is playing a word game with the Papadopoulos deep throat intel. Sometimes you need to go back and reconstruct events. It turns out that when Papadopoulos was blabbing to the Australian about the Russians having embarrassing Hillary emails, everyone was talking about the Russians having embarrassing Hillary emails. When Papadopoulos met Lewandowski and, sorry, we're out of room. As is often the case with Clinton scandals, it's easy to confuse them. But Hillary had two completely different email scandals. Both sets of emails were embarrassing to Hillary. Both were alleged to be in the possession of the Russians, with either the Democrats or the Republicans doing the alleging. First, there were the damn emails that Bernie Sanders was sick of hearing about. The ones our Machiavellian Secretary of State kept on her private server to shield them from a Freedom of Information Act request. Hillary's team successfully scrubbed about 30,000 of her official government emails before the FBI got its hands on her server. None of the missing emails ever showed up on WikiLeaks. They'll probably turn up 2 years from now in the upstairs library of the White House, just like Hillary's Whitewater billing records. Second, totally separately, there were the DNC emails that appeared on WikiLeaks in June 2016, revealing that party officials had schemed against Bernie Sanders, Hillary's opponent. In a desperate attempt at damage control, in July 2016, the Democrats began claiming that Russia had hacked those emails. The FBI confuses the media, not hard, by weaving in and out of the two sets of emails. Hillary's emails as Secretary of State, which were deleted from her private server, and the DNC's emails, which were posted on WikiLeaks. According to the FBI's frantic leaking to the New York Times, George Papadopoulos told Downer in May 2016 that the Russians, quote, had thousands of emails that would embarrass Mrs. Clinton, apparently stolen in an effort to try to damage her campaign. When WikiLeaks began publishing the DNC's emails a few months later, Downer said, "Eureka! These must be the precise emails Papadopoulos was talking about." FBI agents promptly flew to London to meet him. How could Papadopoulos have known about the WikiLeaks emails in advance unless the Trump campaign was colluding with Russia? For newsreaders, there's a much, much, much more likely explanation. It was an explanation that would be well known to the FBI, if not to imbibing Australian diplomats. Hillary's emails had dominated the news for more than a year before Papadopoulos's May 2016 revelry with Alexander Downer. From the moment we found out In March 2015, that Secretary Clinton had installed a private server in her home for government business, speculation ran wild that the Russians were in possession of Hillary's emails. To take you back in time, here are a few other places where someone might have gotten the idea that the Russians were in possession of thousands of emails that would be embarrassing to Hillary. In August 2015, the New York Times reported that the FBI was trying to determine whether foreign powers, especially China or Russia, had gained access to Mrs. Clinton's private server. In September 2015, NPR's Artie Shahani observed that hackers from Russia or China could have targeted Clinton, sent her innocent-looking emails with malicious software attached to break in. A few weeks later, it was revealed that Russian hackers had, in fact, targeted Hillary's private email server at least five times. This was huge news, covered everywhere, even on The View. Hillary's emails were such big news that at the October 13, 2015 Democratic debate, Bernie Sanders had the most famous line of the night when he said about Hillary's private server, "The American people are sick and tired of hearing about your damn emails." In January 2016, former Secretary of Defense and CIA Director Robert Gates said, "The odds are pretty high that China, Russia, and Iran had hacked Hillary's emails." I haven't even mentioned Fox News, where the likelihood of Hillary's private server having been hacked by a foreign power was mentioned approximately every 6 minutes from March 2, 2015 to November 7, 2016. In early 2016, the New York Times rushed out with this exciting news. Security logs of Clinton's email server are said to show no evidence of hacking. She had received spam emails with malicious links from Russia, but it was not clear from the emails alone whether anyone clicked on those links or whether the security was compromised. Yay, Hillary! In a column defending Hillary's honesty, in April 2016, The Times' Nicholas Kristof wrote that her email server may have been penetrated by the Russians, though we don't know that. The possibility that the Russians had emails damaging to Hillary was a story that, for the previous year, was never not in the news. A few weeks later, Papadopoulos shared the amazing, stunning, never-heard-before rumor that the Russians were in possession of emails damaging to Hillary. Maybe Papadopoulos' source knew about Hillary's emails from reading the New York Times. Maybe the Russians got it from the Times just like in Dr. Strangelove. The covert intelligence Papadopoulos spilled to the Australian diplomat was something that everyone who speaks English knew. But according to the FBI, the Trump aide's drunken admission was the smoking gun that so horrified agents that they decided to open an investigation into the presidential campaign of Donald Trump 4 months before the election. Again, Downer may have been completely oblivious to the major international news about Hillary's private server. I don't know him. Perhaps he spends a little too much time drinking with 28-year-olds. But no one at the FBI was oblivious. At that precise moment, the Bureau was concluding its year-long investigation of Hillary's private server. If the excited utterances of a clueless foreign diplomat were really the grounds for the FBI to pursue a contrived Russian conspiracy theory against Trump, we might want to put the Washington Bureau on something simpler, like parking tickets and jaywalking. Chapter 18. Mueller Exposes the Blogging Gap. The standard response to the claim that Mueller is on a witch hunt is, "Oh yeah, well he's caught 19 real witches." MSNBC's Chris Hayes, "The special counsel Russia investigation decried by the president as a hoax and a witch hunt has now charged 19 people with federal crimes. As of tonight, four of those people have already pleaded guilty." Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, "It's not a witch hunt when 17 Russians have been indicted. It's not a witch hunt when some of the most senior members of the Trump campaign have been indicted." CNN's Anderson Cooper, But it's only a witch hunt if you don't find any witches, and they have here. In just a year, the special counsel charged 19 people and three companies, including a former White House advisor. 19, not 10, not 12, but 19. The resistance isn't avoiding details because the details aren't important. They're avoiding details because the details don't help them. The specifics are, Mueller has won a slew of indictments against Trump's short-lived campaign manager, Paul Manafort, for crimes having nothing to do with Trump or the 2016 campaign. He's gotten a few other Trump associates to plead guilty to process crimes like lying to investigators. And he indicted 13 Russian companies and individuals on charges he never thought would go beyond the indictment stage. That's not going to strike most people as proof that Trump colluded with Russia. Mueller's indictment of the 13 Russians on February 16, 2018, was pure political theater. He assumed that there was not the remotest possibility that the accused would show up in any American court to defend themselves, so he could say anything. The sole purpose of the indictment was to put indictment in the same sentence with Russians. Only by perseverating, co-conspirators, illegal, Russian, collusion, can Mueller and his fanboys in the media make a social media marketing plan sound criminal. The grand thesis of the Russian indictments is that computer bots tricked voters into supporting Trump. Yes, Americans would never have realized that Hillary was a screeching harridan if the Russians hadn't told them so. If the Russians really wanted to help Trump win, they would have arranged more TV time for Hillary. There has never been any evidence that simply reading something magically causes people to believe it. Ask Meg Whitman if $140 million made her governor of California. Or come with me to visit the presidential libraries of Jeb exclamation point, Bush, Hillary Clinton, Howard Dean, Phil Graham, John Connolly, and Henry Scoop Jackson. All of them entered presidential election years with more money than any other candidate. When has spending on campaign ads ever worked? But we're supposed to believe that Trump heard about the Russian social media plan and said, if you guys are serious about sinking $100,000 into Facebook ads, there's nothing I wouldn't give you. You purchase those ads, damn straight, I'll give you the nuclear codes. Can you get something on MySpace too? Trump isn't an idiot. The idea that Russian social media postings influence the electorate merely illustrates the utter contempt liberals have for Trump voters. Of course, educated elites wouldn't have fallen for Russian bots and Facebook ads, but idiot Trump voters would. As Evan Osnos of The New Yorker puts it, at the heart of the Russian fraud is an essential, embarrassing insight into American life. Large numbers of Americans are ill-equipped to assess the credibility of the things they read. Even accepting the snooty liberal belief that red state Americans are uniquely suggestible, we had a mainstream media that also kinda had its thumb on the scale during the election. The message from the media could not have been clearer. You are not to vote for Trump. If you do, you are a racist, sexist, xenophobic moron. Trump voters quite clearly were not listening to any media. Mad Russians want more page views. To be sure, the details of the Mueller indictment are shocking. The shock is, the Office of the Independent Counsel knows less about social media than the senators who questioned Mark Zuckerberg. Actual paragraph from the indictment. To measure the impact of their online social media operations, defendants and their co-conspirators tracked the performance of content they posted over social media. They tracked the size of the online U.S. audience reached through posts, different types of engagement with the posts, such as likes, comments, and reposts, changes in audience size, and other metrics. Defendants and their co-conspirators received and maintained metrics reports on certain group pages and individualized posts. Is this a criminal conspiracy or the business plan of HuffPo? No one in Mueller's office seems to realize This is what people do on the internet. They do it for fun, to troll, maybe eventually to make money. The vast majority of bloggers make less than $100 a month. Amazon is the fourth largest public company in the United States, and in 20 years, it has posted profits in only a handful of quarters. Billionaires in the U.S. have paid more for less impressive internet projects. Mueller's evidence that the Russians were trying to swing the election is indistinguishable from evidence that they were trying to generate web traffic. The indictment reads like Monty Python's non-illegal robbery sketch, in which gangsters huddle over a map, meticulously planning a perfectly legal transaction. At 10:51, I shall enter the British Jewelry Center, where you, Vic, disguised as a customer, will meet me and hand me £5.18. At 10:52, I shall approach the counter and purchase a watch costing £5.18. The stated charge is that the Russians committed fraud and deceit to obstruct the lawful functions of the United States government. That's kind of vague. The precise claim is that, using Facebook ads, tweets, and Instagram posts, a dozen Russians managed to overwhelm the entire U.S. media and the Clinton machine. As the Los Angeles Times breathlessly described the Russian scheme outlined in the indictment, thousands of dollars were spent each month buying targeted social media ads with messages such as, "Hillary Clinton doesn't deserve the black vote," and "Hillary is a Satan, and her crimes and lies had proved how evil she is." Not hundreds of dollars, but thousands. Total campaign spending on the 2016 presidential contest was $2.4 billion. If the Russians can flip an American election with 0.83% of total campaign spending, I hope they are running our country. It would run very smoothly. The Russians think we're nuts. As Mueller's indictment admitted, one of the indicted Russians emailed her mother in September 2017 saying, "We had a slight crisis here at work. The FBI busted our activity. Not a joke." To cover for the lunacy of Mueller's indictment, the media supplied the outrage, making Facebook ads sound like the work of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. Here's how Brian Williams opened his MSNBC show, The 11th Hour, the night of the indictment. "The breaking news tonight, the stunning evidence of how far Russia reached into our lives, our media, and our presidential election. Robert Mueller's bombshell indictments, alleging the Russians arrived in this country to turn Americans against one another, psychological and information warfare, that didn't stop with the election." The alleged psychological warfare turning one American against another consisted of Russians posting election-related content on the internet. "Wake me up when you have them changing vote totals." It would be one thing if California or New York had flipped to Trump. But Trump's victory followed the precise path anyone could have predicted it would. Large industrial states in the Midwest went for the guy who said he'd deport illegals and tear up NAFTA. The media gave quite a different picture of the indictment. "A grand conspiracy of Russian election sabotage, a highly sophisticated, well-funded, and vertically integrated enterprise intended to influence voters, effectively a third campaign. A much more far-sweeping conspiracy to violate U.S. election laws than we really knew. Deceptive and malevolent activity. An elaborate plot to interfere in the 2016 U.S. presidential election." The left is fantastic at producing accusatory government documents against the Trump administration, but things always fall apart at the evidence stage. CNN anchor George Howell called the indictment a game changer that laid out the evidence of Russian collusion in black and white, in granular specificity. CNN's Brianna Keeler said, "You are looking here at proof of a systematic effort to meddle in the U.S. election by Russian operatives." CNN's Shimon Prokopets responded, "Yes, it's quite systemic, Brianna. I mean, you're talking about Facebook." On MSNBC's The Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell, Meera Tandon of the Center for American Progress said the indictment really proves what the intelligence agency said over a year ago. It proves what the intelligence agency said and what Donald Trump has been denying on an almost weekly basis. Game over. The evidence was in. Case closed. The only question the resistance wanted answered was, what was Trump going to do about it? As John Dean said on CNN, a normal president would react both proactively and retroactively to such an indictment. It's an indictment. 50 years ago, President Nixon was pilloried for saying Charles Manson was guilty when he was still on trial. Days later, Manson showed the jury the Los Angeles Times 2-inch headline, Manson guilty, Nixon declares. His lawyers promptly moved for a mistrial. With the same confidence of commentators today, journalists hooted about idiot Nixon freeing Manson. No mistrial was declared. Nixon made his off-the-cuff remarks a few weeks into Manson's trial, well past the indictment stage. And, of course, Manson was guilty. Except according to the Washington Post's fact-checker, Glenn Kessler, who doesn't believe the concept of agency applies to criminal law. See Chapter 15. But today, the resistance is appalled that Trump refuses to presume the guilt of the accused based on an indictment that, one, is obviously political, and two, the prosecutor never expected to have to defend in court. They're blogging! The more commentators talked about Mueller's indictment, the more it became clear that no one in the media had actually read it. They just rushed to a thesaurus to find synonyms for malevolent, conspiracy, and sabotage. What is a dark Facebook ad, as a New York Times op-ed called the Russian social media postings? Here's the biggest smoking gun from the indictment. Specialists were instructed to post content that focused on politics in the USA and to use any opportunity to criticize Hillary and the rest, except Sanders and Trump. We support them. If you were only trying to attract clicks, which candidates would you support? That's right, Sanders and Trump. And whom would you bash? According to a quarter century of conservative direct mail, Hillary Clinton. Ever since Hillary first entered the national consciousness in 1992, she has been a fundraising magnet for conservatives. Mail a $20 check to the Heritage Foundation, and every week for the rest of your life, you'll get 16 mailings promising to stop Hillary. The father of direct mail, Richard Viguerie, told the New York Times in 2007 that his Hillary Clinton mailings were the most successful he'd had in 40 years of fundraising. If the Russians were trying to swing the election to Trump, their message was a little confused. They sponsored groups supporting Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Jill Stein, Black Lives Matter, Muslims, Christians, and Heart of Texas, among others. Some were even supportive of Hillary. Again, this is according to Mueller's own indictment. Is he holding the good stuff back? Especially tricky to explain is the fact that right after the election, the Russian troll farm leapt on the resistance bandwagon. Again, according to the Mueller indictment, these same Russians who were desperate to elect Trump sponsored a Trump is not my president rally in New York and a Charlotte against Trump rally in North Carolina a few weeks after the election. The Russian conspiracy is like global warming. No matter what the facts are, it proves the existence of global warming. So too, no matter what the evidence, Russia was screwing with our election. When attacking Trump, we have a new scientific method. The conclusion comes first, then data is invented to support it. To explain why some Russian social media groups supported Hillary, and some even promoted the resistance, the Russian conspiracy to elect Trump simply transformed into the Russian conspiracy to sow discord. According to Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, Mueller's indictment reveals the Russians' plan to promote discord in the United States and undermine public confidence in democracy. If the Russians were trying to sow discord and undermine confidence in our democracy, then the guy they probably colluded with was Robert Mueller. After the fact, a conspiracy can be imposed on any set of facts. The resistance should have a game show where contestants compete to see who can turn ordinary events into a Russian conspiracy the fastest. A few years ago, I discovered a guy, Greg Packer, who is quoted in nearly every man-on-the-street interview in the New York media. He was quoted buying Hillary's Living History on his reaction to military strikes against Iraq at the St. Patrick's Day Parade, the Thanksgiving Day Parade, and the Veterans Day Parade. He was quoted at not one, but two New Year's Eve celebrations in Times Square. He was quoted at the opening of a new Star Wars movie, an H&M clothing store on Fifth Avenue, and the viewing stand at Ground Zero. He was quoted at Yankees games, Mets games, Jets games, even getting tickets for the Brooklyn Cyclones. Last year, he was quoted on Cardinal Dolan's flu keeping him from Christmas Mass at St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York. After I wrote a column mentioning Packer's ubiquity as the media's man on the street, he showed up at one of my book signings to shout insults at me. Days later, he was at another one of my events, shouting marriage proposals. If they thought hard enough, I'm sure Mueller's top-flight attorneys could come up with a conspiracy to explain Packer's behavior. But Occam's Razor says he likes to read his name in the newspaper. And Occam's Razor also says the Russians were sponsoring different social media groups to attract followers. The day the indictment was released, Facebook's vice president for ads, Rob Goldman, tweeted, "I have seen all of the Russian ads, and I can say very definitively that swaying the election was not the main goal." He added, "The majority of the Russian ad spend happened after the election." Nazi bloc watchers in the press quickly pounced on Goldman, announcing that it was against company policy for a Facebook executive to talk to the media. Journalists were aghast that a rogue insider, speaking on a matter of public importance, had violated corporate policy. The New York Times claimed that Goldman eventually walked back his tweets. In fact, all he did was clarify the painfully obvious point that his tweets had nothing to do with Russia hacking the DNC's emails. Yes, and his tweets also had nothing to do with Stormy Daniels, Benghazi, or Hope Hicks' boyfriend beating his wives. Not much of a walk back, New York Times. In one case mentioned in the indictment, a Russian-based Facebook group, United Muslims of America, sponsored a rally called "Support Hillary, Save American Muslims." The Russians produced participants on both sides of the rally, persuading one U.S. person to show up holding a sign that read, "I think Sharia law will be a powerful new direction of freedom," attributing the quote to Hillary. Head Russian: "How is this supposed to work again?" Assistant Russian: "When Americans find out Muslims support Hillary, she is dead." Cut to Khizr Khan standing with his hijab-wearing wife, denouncing Trump in a thick Pakistani accent at the Democratic National Convention. The special counsel's most hilarious accusation was that the Russian social media posts had suppressed the black vote for Hillary. What else could possibly explain how Hillary got less of the black vote than Obama? Keep thinking that, liberals. Paragraph 46A of Mueller's indictment states, "On or about October 16, 2016, defendants and their co-conspirators used the organization-controlled Instagram account Woke Blacks to post the following message. A particular hype and hatred for Trump is misleading the people and forcing blacks to vote Hillary. We cannot resort to the lesser of two devils. Then we'd surely be better off without voting at all." Reporters were blown away. "Do we need to draw you a picture?" The fact is, CNN political analyst Jonathan Martin said, "Reading this indictment, the Russians tried to suppress Hillary Clinton's vote, especially with black voters. We've thought and we've thought and we've thought, but nothing else explains why black turnout would be smaller for Hillary than for the first black president. Speaking as a black man, New York Times op-ed contributor Noam Cohen took the Russian suppression of the black vote personally. As Cohen explained, dark Facebook ads bought by suspected Russian fronts were designed to depress black support for Hillary Clinton. The 2016 election, Cohen triumphantly announced, saw a 7 percentage point decrease in African American turnout from 2012. Idiots! What could explain that except a Russian plot? MSNBC's Chris Matthews said the Russians know what they're doing. African-American voters who didn't vote would probably be for Hillary. That's a reasonable assumption. Get them not to vote. Google, this is the last time we vote for an all-white ticket, to see if there might be another explanation for the lower black turnout for Hillary. 2 months before the Russians mesmerized black voters with an Instagram post from Woke Blacks, Quanell X, leader of the People's New Black Panther Party in Houston, said on local TV, "I ask us to truly examine what Trump said, because it is a fact that for 54 years, we have been voting for the Democratic Party like no other race in America. We are being pimped like prostitutes, and they're the big pimps pimping us politically, promising us everything, and we get nothing in return." The media knew damn well that African Americans were not head over heels about Hillary. The fact that Trump was out there asking black people for their vote enraged them. HuffPo, Milwaukee's African American leaders pan Trump's speech on race and policing. In September 2016, days after Quanell X's derogatory remarks about the Democrats, Trump appeared at the Great Faith Ministries International Church in Detroit and got a standing ovation from the congregation. As Trump was being blessed by the black minister, a Reuters cameraman can be heard on video refusing to stop filming, as his supervisor was evidently demanding. "I'm not leaving," he said. "I'm shooting this. I don't care what. I'll take a demotion for this." But it was probably the Russians' October 16th Instagram post, seen by 17 people, that depressed Hillary's black vote. Happy birthday is code for our precious bodily fluids. Another Russian trick to flip the election to Trump, important enough to be cited in Mueller's indictment, involved the Ruskies persuading some random American to take a picture of himself standing in front of the White House with a sign that read, "Happy 55th birthday, dear boss," the day before the 55th birthday of the Russian oligarch funding them. The indictment doesn't clarify what percentage of the Russian firm's social media posts were nonpartisan pranks, like birthday messages for their bosses. Our media's pranks were never nonpartisan. Leaving aside the $1.2 billion spent by the Democrats to get Hillary elected, from the moment Trump announced, the entire mainstream media turned their newsrooms over to a 24/7 Stop Trump operation, amounting to approximately a gazillion dollars of in-kind donations to the Clinton campaign. The resistance's argument is that the left's total 100% domination of the American media was no match for 13 Russians. The sole purpose of Mueller's indictment of the Russians was, as the New York Times admitted, to name and shame the alleged operatives. Everyone assumed that none of the accused Russians would ever show up to defend themselves. The indictment was clearly a message document, Robert Litt, former national intelligence lawyer, told the New York Times. Mueller wants to end the debate. Harvard professor Jack Goldsmith called the indictment a remarkable rebuke of the president, which was the only point. As with the evidence-free report by American intelligence agencies, the indictment served merely to educate the American public about the Russian conspiracy. It was so cool, so great, such a diss of Trump. right up until the charges had to be tested in court. Then Mueller's prosecutors lost their mojo. When one of the indicted Russian corporations sent lawyers to the arraignment, suddenly the independent counsel's evidence was not so watertight. As BuzzFeed News put it, everyone thought the Russians wouldn't bother to defend themselves against Mueller's charges. Then this happened. Mueller's attorneys rushed to court to request a delay and began furiously raising technical objections. Meanwhile, the Russian corporation asserted its right to a speedy trial. Although the special counsel's office wasn't ready to prosecute even one Russian defendant, prosecutor and Hillary donor, Jeannie Rhee, claimed the office would be thrilled if all the defendants showed up. I bet. It would be one thing if all this conspiracy mongering were to prove Russian perfidy and it were 1970. But there's no Soviet Union anymore. It was you guys, New York Times, who struggled mightily to tell us to calm down about mass murdering Soviet communists. Hello, Strobe Talbot? Now we're supposed to be flipped out over the Red Menace? Yes, we are. And the evidence of their depravity is a few million dollars in Facebook ads. The resistance needs to get a new hobby. Chapter 19. Michael Cohen. Liberals discover the bright side of bullying. The gleeful destruction of Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, suggests that liberals may not be quite so serious as they claim to be about protecting a suspect's legal rights. And their beatification of porn star Stormy Daniels is a little hard to square with their indignation over the Access Hollywood tape. Stormy Daniels' lawsuit against Trump led to religious ecstasies in the press. The gravamen of her complaint is that she never imagined Trump would become president, and if she had, she certainly would not have agreed to take so little money in exchange for her silence about her alleged affair with him. So she sued to be released from the non-disclosure agreement. Apart from the fact that making a bad business deal does not state a cause of action, Daniels didn't exactly seem encumbered by her vow of silence. The press indignantly accused Cohen and Trump of lying about the payment to Daniels. Journalists think they are at the point where tectonic plates meet in the center of history when they catch Trump's personal lawyer sending an email to a porn star's lawyer from a Trump Organization address. ABC's World News Tonight with David Muir, March 9, 2018. There is word tonight that Trump's personal lawyer used his Trump Organization email to arrange payment. CNN Tonight, March 9, 2018. Michael Avenatti, Stormy Daniels' attorney. If you look at the email, the top, the last email in the string, it talks about how the office is closed for Yom Kippur. Anderson Cooper, host. The Trump Organization offices? Avenatti. That is correct. And Anderson, if I could set the stage relating to this email. MSNBC's The Beat with Ari Melber, March 9, 2018. There's also a new report here that Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, used his Trump email address to arrange the details of this transfer. Boring facts can be used to prove big crimes, but in the case of Cohen's payment to a porn star, what we have is a boring fact being used to prove a boring crime, an alleged violation of the campaign finance laws. Worse, they're trying to prove a reporting violation. If Trump paid the $130,000 himself solely to help his campaign, and he wouldn't have minded at all having a porn star telling the tabloids she'd had sex with him except for the fact that he was running for president, it would be a reporting violation. And oh my gosh, he'd have to pay a fine! Their argument is, what if he didn't pay it himself? That's why they're obsessed with when and how Cohen emailed the lawyer, trying to find breadcrumbs that someone else paid Stormy in order to claim it was an illegal campaign contribution. Again, requiring that the payment be motivated solely by the fact that Trump was running for office. This is how they lure you into arguing about something that doesn't matter. In the 1990s, Chinese nationals were literally dragging duffel bags of money into the DNC as President Clinton allowed sensitive ballistic missile guidance technology to be transferred to the Chinese government. No charges, no independent counsel. Clinton held illegal campaign fundraisers at the White House, where Chinese citizens handed checks directly to White House staff. Still, no charges and no independent counsel. Videotapes of the White House fundraiser surfaced, featuring the president and vice president glad-handing campaign donors on federal property. And again, no charges, no independent counsel. The New York Times response to Attorney General Janet Reno's refusal to assign an independent counsel to these textbook campaign finance violations was a forceful editorial, lightly ribbing Reno for her blunders. Saturday Night Live was tougher on the Attorney General. Weekend Update with Norm MacDonald, November 8, 1997. With the release of over 100 hours of videotape of President Clinton at campaign fundraisers, the pressure continues to mount on Attorney General Janet Reno to name an independent counsel to investigate the president. In addition, some senators are said to be furious that, instead of watching the videotapes, Reno has been taping over them with episodes of Xena, Warrior Princess. But now we're supposed to care that Trump's personal lawyer lied about a legal payment to, depending on your point of view, a mistress or an opportunistic grifter. And he used a Trump Organization email address. Did you hear the one about John Edwards? Lying to the press isn't a crime, and paying money to cover up an affair isn't a crime either, even if you're running for president. If these were crimes, John Edwards would be on death row. As a presidential candidate in 2008, Edwards lied up a storm about getting his mistress pregnant as his wife was dying of cancer. Only through the generous support of his well-heeled donors was he able to hide his mistress from the public. This donor-funded scam went on for months until the National Enquirer finally caught Edwards visiting his mistress and newborn baby in the Beverly Hilton Hotel. Edwards was later charged with campaign finance violations for using campaign funds to hide an affair. The prosecution was widely ridiculed, and the jury returned a verdict of not guilty. If that's not a violation of the campaign finance laws, then Trump's $130,000 payment to Daniels sure isn't. The Trump exception to the Fourth Amendment. Soon after Cohen came under investigation on a referral from the independent counsel, his law office was raided. We were assured by eminent legal scholars that a raid on a lawyer's office would not be undertaken without good cause. The prosecutors must have had some serious evidence against Cohen because the raid would require approval from a judge and top Justice Department officials. Why Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein had signed off on it. The last time we heard that exact excuse, it was about the FISA warrant on Carter Page. A judge approved it. Rod Rosenstein signed off on it. Only later did we find out the warrant had been corruptly obtained with Hillary Clinton's Russia dossier. Rosenstein signed off on it is no longer your best argument, liberals. Almost immediately after the raid, Cohen's private information began pouring out to the press. First, a private hush money deal Cohen had negotiated for a wealthy Republican fundraiser was leaked to the media. It is not a crime to pay money to avoid embarrassment. In fact, I believe the whole point of paying a Playboy bunny $1.6 million was to avoid having it lead the news for days on end. No one in the press cared about this stunning breach of privacy. They were too busy leering over the details of the hush money arrangement. The resistance's position was, the Republican donor was friends with Trump. He deserved it. A few weeks after the raid, Cohen's personal banking transactions were plastered all over the news. For obvious reasons, it's a very serious crime to leak private financial records. But the press didn't mind the government illegally